Hello and welcome to the Nursing World Share Practice Forum. My name is Julie Wade. I am the nursing director of the Hematopoietic Stem Cell Transplant Unit here at Boston Children's Hospital. And I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Andrea Wallace, who is a professor and dean of research at the University of Utah College of Nursing. Our primary objective for Dr. Wallace's research is to design high-quality healthcare service interventions to narrow clinical outcome gaps while simultaneously understanding how these interventions can be implemented without research resources or during routine care. She has successfully partnered with interdisciplinary clinicians and researchers to develop means of feasibility and effectively incorporating self-management interventions in primary care practice settings, serving vulnerable patient populations, and to understand the impact of social factors on team communication and the transitions between inpatient and primary care settings. Most recently, Dr. Wallace's ARC and NIH-funded research program has focused on methods to account for patients' social determinants of health during inpatient and emergency department discharge planning and risk modeling. Due to her methodological interest in implementing research in clinical settings, Dr. Wallace regularly serves on scientific review panels for the NIH and the PCORI with a specific focus on social health integration and implementation science. Dr. Wallace teaches and mentors as part of her graduate nursing, public health, and medicine programs. Welcome, Dr. Wallace. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks, Julie.
Andrea, I know that you have done a lot of work in areas of social determinants of health. How did you pique an interest in this to lead to this area of research?
Well, I mean, I think it was really grounded in my clinical experiences, where I really observed early on that there were so many different social factors that I would be working with patients in terms of their access to transportation, to insurance, to social support, and around their ability to read and comprehend written information, whether it be numbers or words. And I think that I rapidly realized that no matter what we did in clinic, if we couldn't make it work within that context, that it wasn't going to matter what I did in clinic if it wasn't going to work once a patient left the visit or left the hospital. So that's really what piqued my interest. The other thing is some observations that I really wanted to figure out with patients what worked for them, even if they had these social factors at play. People have very different contexts and supports in place, and some people can do quite well with a lot of different social circumstances, and really trying to figure out how we can understand that. Recognizing that oftentimes in visits, or particularly during hospitalizations, we understand these social factors completely by accident. You know, it's whether or not I ran into the neighbor or the daughter or the spouse, right? In terms of, oh, wow, Mrs. Jones lives at the top of, you know, this building and it's all stairs and there's no way that what we have in place is going to work for her after she's discharged. Things like that we don't really do a good job of tracking in our current medical records in the EHRs, or just even when we change shifts and we work in discharge teams. That's really where it stemmed from.
And what have you learned to best facilitate seeing this through and or some barriers that you found?
Well, I mean, I think it's been this evolving project, a series of projects, really, to try to figure out how you gather this information and how you communicate it, and then how you link to resources outside of the health system, because that's really key, right? We're not going to address all of these factors within a visit or a hospitalization. So really, though, there have been more barriers to doing that than I think we would have ever expected, which again speaks to when you're engaged in evidence-based practice work or quality work, you have to have a lot of patience to understand that you might have to navigate some of these. And some of the barriers really are more about our clinicians' reluctance to ask some questions about patients' social circumstances when they don't feel they can respond, if you don't have the resources to respond. Likewise, patients aren't so sure they want to have some of these questions. And when I'm talking about these questions, I'm talking food insecurity and housing instability and transportation barriers and childcare and elder care. Those are some of the questions we ask, in addition to access to funds or insurance for medical visits or medications. And these aren't comfortable conversations always to have. We talk a lot about sensitive information all day long as clinicians, but there's something different about this that I don't think that we recognized until we got into it. So right now we're working with how do we help clinicians feel comfortable having these conversations? How can we facilitate connections so they feel like they do have some resources to rely on that they feel like might be useful to patients? Likewise, messaging to patients, making sure patients don't feel like they're being profiled or are vulnerable when they're disclosing the information, making them feel like there's some reason that we're asking versus that goes beyond just checking a box for us and filling out the forms, that we really do care about their social circumstances. And even if we can't address those social circumstances, that we're doing it because we really want to know how to best account for it and get them to the best health possible. So those are really important things for both the patients and the clinician side. So yeah, that's what we're working on now.
This work you're doing is fascinating and so important. Let's change gears and talk a little bit about how you keep up with the evidence-based practice. You know, being in the computer age, we have a huge amount of new information on evidence-based practice coming to us all the time. How do you feel that you keep up with this new information so that you can incorporate this into your work?
So the first thing, I read, and I read a lot. I mean, that I think is key. I mean, constantly trying to absorb the information that's out there that we have available in our library systems and of course the journals. A lot of different areas where you get emails. I am tied to professional organizations that constantly send out information. And I found that very helpful, particularly now when we have so much of that. But my role is also that, you know, I also need to understand the context in which evidence is being placed as well. So in terms of actual decision-making, in terms of, you know, when we're talking about a research program and how to implement things into practice, I use a lot of my own experience and awareness of my local environment and trends nationally to ask whether we can make something work in the care environment. And that extends, of course, when you're doing EBP, when you're in a clinical setting, but it also has to do with whether or not you can actually test or implement research in those settings as well. So I think that all of that goes hand in hand and feeds one another, really making sure that you're, of course, tied to the evidence and keeping up with that, but also really making sure that you're out there and you're connected to the care teams who might actually be using it.
Yes, that's a great point. So what would you recommend for those that prefer learning in other ways or truly just don't have a lot of time to read because of all their clinical demands? Are there other ways that clinicians can gather and evaluate evidence to inform their practice or decision-making process?
If you're not necessarily a big consumer of the research literature, there are other high-quality, you know, sources of information. As I mentioned, the professional organizations, they send out a lot of sort of bite-sized pieces of information that I think helps at least me keep current of saying, oh, wow, that's happening in this health system. I think I need to click on that and read more about that. There actually, and I've heard, and I don't use them myself, but I think there's a lot of really high quality health system podcasts out there. So I think I've heard of that, of people getting to fit in their exercise while learning about what should be happening out there.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I myself have taken on listening to podcasts more frequently, and I would not have thought to use it in that form. So that's a great suggestion. What advice would you give to like newer professionals who are just starting their journey to incorporate evidence-based practice into their work?
The first thing is I would say never to underestimate the power of your network to get things done. I mean, so many successes in this work, perhaps really the majority of the successes, can be attributed to your ability to incorporate others and bringing people along. behavior change is very hard on an individual level. I think we can all identify that. And when we're talking about behavior change in terms of a health system, it's incredibly complex and difficult. So I think preparing yourself to become frustrated, which is why it's critical to have your trusted support system in this work. And also, it's incredibly rewarding to share successes with a team as well. So I think it's just, it's a lot more fun, it's a lot more engaging, and it really is necessary to the work. I mean, one person is not going to make significant impact and practice changes and making sure you're incorporating the right evidence without a group of invested professionals.
Yes, Andrea, I think it's great that you take frustration into consideration. Oftentimes people may become discouraged throughout the process when the evidence doesn't support what you might think is really going to happen, or it takes a while to implement your evidence-based practice. So it's important to realize that it's part of our process and not that easy. Hopefully in the end, you will be able to showcase your work and make changes in the clinical environment. So I agree and truly appreciate that advice.
Yeah, and I think that so much of my work has talked about sort of navigating those frustrations and really trying to figure out, I mean, it's a first step in a really long process oftentimes. And you'll fix one thing, and ideally, as people get excited about it, which is so gratifying when a mentee gets excited about making practice changes that stem from the initial practice change, but it oftentimes is the beginning of a journey. So just as we tell, doctoral students that your dissertation isn't going to change the world, prepare yourself for that. Unlikely. It's unlikely to change the world. Some do, but it is just the first step in many years of doing this type of work. And likewise, if you're at the bedside or if you're a doctorally prepared nurse, it's the same deal. It's a road to continue to do things better.
So just a segue into, if you know, we just talked about the frustration piece of it, but what other challenges or barriers would you be able to offer that typically professionals do commonly face when trying to integrate evidence-based practice into their work? And you know, what would you suggest of how they can overcome these challenges? Because it's a very long process, and it's going to be challenging throughout, and so that they don't give up.
Yeah, I think it's things that everyone listening today will be able to anticipate, right? It's competing demands and resource constraints, and that can be time or money or staffing or some other resource that pertains to a project. That will always be part of the equation that you have to work through. And we continue to face unprecedented levels of burnout, you know, within our profession and across healthcare in general. And I also think that we have a lot of disruptions on the horizon constantly in our clinical environments. I think of recent projects that I've worked on where there's the overwhelmingly fast pace of technological advances and health systems' hunger for those advances. And so that's a huge challenge too, to constantly be anticipating and navigating these disruptions that are going to happen when you're in the middle of a project, or you're trying to anticipate that you can't even anticipate happening until you're in the middle of it. One minute you have a plan, and the next it's being disrupted by some other competing demand. And oftentimes lately it's been, I think, a lot of technology emerging, which it can be really positive. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of potential there, but it's constantly shifting. And in terms of overcoming those, I mean, it's anticipating those as your barriers and really thinking through, how can I create plans, implementation plans around trying to navigate those, knowing that you're going to have to design your intervention in sort of these smaller pieces, you know, not expecting a lot of time and energy from clinicians, making it easy, making it cost effective. Making it fit within workflows that are already in place. Those are all things that will go very far when you're trying to overcome those challenges. Making it respond to your stakeholders who, again, have sort of competing priorities sometimes than those that you're trying to address.
Could you just speak a little bit about from your experience where evidence-based practice led to a significant improvement or outcome and something that you're very proud of?
So I often think back to my experience as a clinical nurse specialist in internal medicine, and that was where I worked to implement a lot of practice guidelines related to various conditions, blood pressure control, diabetes management, depression management. Worked with a fantastic interdisciplinary team, and all of whom are major health leaders in other ways. And I think that the work we did in terms of depression management, at least when I was more, you know, embedded in a clinical role, really did get everyone's attention at the time about how we weren't being, how patients on SSRIs weren't being adequately monitored and titrated. So in that clinic, it was very rewarding because we were able to get some movement in that direction. Again, we didn't have, there were barriers in place for sure in terms of culture around that and who should be doing that. But we really integrated some nurse practice models that were able to ensure that patients were followed better and more thoroughly. And I think lately, I mean, in more recent examples, our work about integrating social risk screening as part of clinical care, where we really don't have a lot of evidence, but what we've collected so far has been applied to our practice setting. And it's super rewarding when someone says, hey, do you have an idea for how to address this? And our team can say, yes, we actually do. And thank you for asking. So it is, you know, it's flattering. It's flattering to have someone interested and more importantly, to feel like you're contributed to this collective awareness of where we can go in a forum, and knowing that it should be adapted to people's unique settings and their needs. But it's again, super rewarding to be part of improving that process in real time.
I love that. And, you know, as we noted earlier on, when we were, when I was introducing you about your passion for looking into focusing on social health integration, could you share some examples where considering these factors maybe led to more effective outcomes in your work?
Well, I know it's an area that's gained a lot of attention recently, even though it's been an interest area for mine for many years now. So this is actually an example, too, of things that end up facilitating evidence-based practice development and adoption, because we've seen this all the time in healthcare. You know, there are new trends, if you will, just like any place else, of what gets a lot of attention. And right now, social determinants, of course, is one of those. But knowing about social determinants is critical and absolutely necessary to ensure that we can stick to evidence-based treatments, and at least in the outpatient world. And for the most part, my focus there has been on the outpatient side, or at least as part of discharge planning. And I think a lot of clinicians can resonate with this, but when I often think of a particular example. You know, when we talk about evidence-based practice and you think of an individual patients, right? And the one I always go to in terms of an example of how we need to integrate this more is that we had a patient at one time who we were working with who had end-stage renal disease and diabetes and could not get her blood sugar stable. And medications were being shifted and titrated all the time. We knew it wasn't optimal. We were really risking harm. And in fact, we were all a bit scared because we knew that her blood sugar was highly variable. But it wasn't until I had extra time one day to really dig into what she understood, her finances and her ability to read and what was going on. And when we started talking, it took a while. But what I realized is she was purchasing the recommended brand of nutrition drinks that she was largely relying on for calories, but she was rotating the high and low carb versions. And so she didn't understand the labeling. She didn't understand what it meant. And once we figured that out, we were able to get her on a gold standard medication regimen. We were able to get her stable and get her into some nutrition that she could actually afford better. So, and again, I know that that's a common, you know, we all have those experiences with patients, but it just really is an example of these are social circumstances, and they have huge impacts on and what we do in healthcare and how well we can help manage patients, help them with their conditions. And again, you know, EBP, when we opened our conversation, you know, it's based on patient preferences and their experiences and their lived context. And Our best evidence, at least when it comes to self-management and anything outpatient, it won't work unless it's aligned with the patient's own social context. I mean, it simply won't work. They won't, you know, people can't oftentimes do what we ask them to do in clinical settings, or they can do it differently or something, but this requires a lot of digging into their social contexts. And I know that our efforts to hardwire that into the system has to lead to improvements over time. So as we build that evidence base, that's where I'm really passionate about it, and leading to this sort of substantive improvement in this area.
So important, such important work. I love that. I love your passion for it as well.
Thank you.
Any final words of wisdom or thought that you would like to leave for an audience that's looking into just starting out with evidence-based practice, or just final thoughts for someone that has done so much work?
I think, you know, just recognizing this isn't easy work. I think, you know, and to not lose heart if you get into a clinical environment where you're really trying to make change and it doesn't immediately happen. It's a problem solving process. Be open to that problem solving, be open to what you're learning. I think that I continually have to remind myself in my own career, even at this point in my career, to listen. Listening is the strongest, you know, it is the most important skill to have carrying into this work. Just be open, listen, rely on a team of collaborators, ask them questions. And I know that where you are, you have a fantastic system of experts that you all could take advantage of. And hopefully it'll spark some interest. I mean, this is a career long endeavor, and it's so critical that we have nurses invested in this work, because we all want this type of care. We all want a nurse to take care of us who is grounded in the evidence and who truly cares about using it to advocate for you as a patient. We all want that type of care. So I guess that would be my parting wisdom. Just be patient with yourselves and listen and know that there will be barriers.
Yes, absolutely. And I would add, make sure you find a mentor.
Yes. You know, the expert collaborators, but yes.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's like they get you through it, and it's that person that can also give you, you know, constructive feedback. Yes. And, you know, go through it with you, but you want someone that is as invested in this process as you are. But that's who, you know, some days are gonna be easier or harder than others. So just having that person to lean on is, I think, key. And
ideally a team of mentors.
Yes, a team would be amazing. Yes.
The mentors sometimes change over time depending on what you need. And so hopefully, yeah, it's those are your people. But having some mentors in your proverbial back pocket is key.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to meet and discuss evidence-based practice. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Julie. I appreciate it.